Today is Friday, August 19th, and I'm Jeff Machoda, and today I'm going to interview Shelley Masser about Nature's Table. So we're going to start off, Shelley, with talking about what brought you to Champaign-Urbana and when, and then the beginning of the table.
Okay. I came in 1975. I had been having a hard time getting through undergraduate stuff. I was a modern dancer, and I met, I was in Santa Cruz at a University of Santa Cruz at a dance, whatever it was, workshop. And artificial intelligence, International Artificial Intelligence, was having a conference at Santa Cruz also. And so by the pool, I met this computer scientist who was interested in getting computers to problem solve via induction. He was from Poland. He taught at the U of I. And he thought that I was too smart to be a dancer. And I didn't realize that in his mind, a dancer was a pole dancer. He had no understanding of modern dance as an art form. Anyway, I followed him to town, and Dan Perino hired me to be an assistant to the Dean of Women, and I got into the Department of Leisure Studies, and I was interested. I wanted to do, my father was a sociologist, and I'd always sort of been skitsy about art versus social science.
What was the name of the professor that you had met?
And the professor I met, his name was Richard Michalski. So, anyway, many long stories to tell in that cleavage. I got a degree in sociology of leisure, where I did reading about subcultures like jazz, like modern dance, like folk dance, and how participation in these subcultures changed people's lives. And I loved jazz because here it was this, it required technical virtuosity and collaboration. It valued freedom. It valued improvisation. It had heroes, but they were not, and they were celebrities, but only in the subculture. They weren't, it didn't have to do with money. The people pursued it really through the values of the jazz itself, of the music itself. It wasn't about making money.
So was there a class that specifically taught this? Or
well, it was sort of in the zeitgeist of the time. At that time, we really thought that we were going to have four-day work weeks. We thought that leisure, and it, you weren't going to be just a wage slave, although that was not a term that we used at that time. You weren't going to be making a living wasn't going to be as important as the things you did for your identity, for yourself, although identity was not a word we used then either. So I loved, there was Howard Becker wrote a famous book about subcultures, the subculture of jazz, and that just really struck me. My father had liked jazz. The first record he ever gave me was Ahmad Jamal. My parents had lived in New York City. My father taught at Rutgers, and when I would go, we would go into the city and listen to jazz. I was probably conceived in the Greenwich Village. I'd grown up listening to folk music, Dylan, and singing through the civil rights movement. So that, but I'd pretty much come to the edge of an interest in folk, and jazz was just right there. I just loved it. My brain would light up. Anyway, so another thing that was in the zeitgeist of leisure studies at that time, in addition to not working anymore, working four-day work weeks, was the idea of small places, places where you would go to be. You'd be accepted as a human being. You didn't have to show your name, rank, and serial number. You would just be there with friends who would love you and you know, live, be fellow travelers. You live your life in the local bar. Now, churches were another place that that happened. I wasn't interested in churches so much. So the idea of the, and there was an article that struck me very much about, you know, if you can't be an actor, if you fail as an actor, or in my case, a modern dancer, the next best thing was to run a bar, because you have all these people and you can be yourself and live a character. And so those were my presets. And I left the Polish computer scientist fairly early on and found myself at large in this town. And I would go to Zorba's and listen to the Jack Webb Band, or that place on Neal Street, the Great Pickle or something like that. I forget what it was called.
It would be the Ground Round back then.
The Ground Round.
Right?
Yeah, it was earlier than the Ground Round even.
Okay.
It did have a name like the Great Pickle, but it wasn't that. And I'd go there, and it would be me and Vicki Alexander in the audience, and she would be reading, and Ron would get mad at her for reading. Why are you reading when we're playing this music? So that was trad jazz. It was, you know, and it, the polyphony of trad jazz, the poignancy was funeral music. You know, it was let's dance our way to the cemetery music. Let's, you know, drink for we know not where we go nor why music. It was fabulous. I loved it. So
this is probably 77 or 78?
This was 75.
75, okay.
Yeah, 76, 77. And then I got this degree in sociology of leisure. I wrote my 250-page thing on how your leisure practices change over your life cycle. I mean, when you're young and single and you're looking for a mate, you go some places. When you're first hooked up with somebody, you do other kinds of things with them. When you have children, it changes because you want to entertain your children and blah, blah, blah. It changes throughout the life. It was sort of like, and I got disillusioned at social science. That's obvious. Why would you have to prove that? But I did a whole study with interviews and statistical study about I don't know if this is interesting, but anyway,
yeah,
took some people who had gone to college at the U of I and talked to them 10 years later to see how their leisure practices had changed. Did a statistical survey, finding out that you had to write dissertations about why creativity is a good experience.
All right, we're picking up. So you were doing interviews with people 10 years after your studies?
And talking about how their leisure life had changed. Anyway, I realized that I did not want to write about creativity. I wanted to foster it. I wanted to participate in it. I wanted to be in it. And I also had decided early on that I was a Midwesterner. If I went to New York City or the coasts, I'd be a dime a dozen. Somebody, you know, with an elitist education who was doing stuff. And I knew I didn't have the confidence I didn't think I had the ability to pull anything off on the coast. The money, I wasn't interested in earning as much money as you'd need to live there. But I thought I could make a difference, having been raised with solid bohemian social justice values, to do something here. So that was my preset. So I got the master's in leisure studies and enrolled myself in the dance department. I'm not sure why, just because I guess I liked being in school. That's what I could do. So I did. And I was at that point 20, it was a few years later, so I was 28. I was 25 when I came here. So that was pretty old to be in ballet classes.
Where everybody was 21 or younger?
Where people were younger. And if they were my age, they were coming out of careers in dancing in the cities. And I was very interested in ballet, which I was learning as an adult. And, you know, you learn ballet when you're 8, not when you're 28. But I was fascinated by it. But it was grueling. And so the year that I started was the year that Terry and Jeff Cross, Terry Masser and Jeff Cross, had opened this little coffee shop across from Krannert Center where the dance classes were. So I would go into the coffee shop to have a cup of coffee to get the energy, some peanut brittle, which they sold, because I was a dancer, I didn't eat anything, and a glass of wine to calm down enough to be able to endure what I had to endure to be what I perceived of as older and perhaps less well-trained than others. And Terry or Jeff was behind the counter.
So this would be spring of 1979?
This would be the fall, September of 1979. Okay. And they had just opened the place. And I think Jeff would flirt with me more and give me the peanut brittle pretty much for free. Terry would make me pay for it, but I thought he was incredibly handsome. He had kind of a scar on his head. He was blonde, leonine, beautiful. And he had a kind of beauty that reminded me very much of my father. And we were both pretty shy. Oh, the other thing I wanted at that point was to get out of my head. I tended always to be political. I took my the Marxism that was the zeitgeist when I went to school. All of our teachers were Marxists, and I took it very seriously. And I would go to a party even as a 12-year-old and stand around analyzing the way people were dressed and what they were doing and the dating rituals and the class things. And I'd burn through friends pretty fast who would say, you know, Shelley, I just like to go and dance. I wanted that. So I was looking to get out of my head. And the only thing I could think of that would do that would be drugs. And I just had an intuitive sense that something about Nature's Table would, this place and these people might take me there. So hooking up with Terry, who had long had a daily habit of smoking pot and an interest in cocaine. We went on a first date, and we went to see Fleetwood Mac.
In Champaign?
In Champaign. They were coming to the assembly hall, and he pulled out this large bag of white stuff. Never seen it before in my life. Anyway, I quickly slipped into a world of smoking pot and occasionally the lines of cocaine, which were perfect for being a dancer. You get the energy, you don't eat, what's not to love? And now I'm just realizing maybe there's things in this story I shouldn't be telling. But I said to Terry, we after that first date, that was sometime in November, and we were together ever after that date, pretty much. We married 6 weeks later.
6 weeks?
Yeah, and we went to Florida together with Raymond Timponi, and had a wild and crazy time down there, met his parents. But I said, okay, here's what we're going to do. You got to have this band here. It'd be just perfect to have the Jack Webb band. We have to get a piano. So Mary Raitt and I went to Piano People, and Mary helped pick out the Mason Hamlin upright, which we moved into the table, and we had the Jack Webb band come and play. Well, first people, when we had the piano in, was Dave Dreyer and
Brian Wilkie.
Brian Wilkie.
Can I backtrack for a second?
Sure.
So when you were going in there, and you said Jeff and Terry were working, mm-hmm. was there a full menu? Was there all the food at that point yet?
No gondolette. There was, all I remember is peanut brittle and a huge coppery espresso machine.
Okay.
Fabulous old thing. No cookies, nothing like that. You have to ask Terry. Damn you, Terry. Jeff Cross would remember too. You should probably talk to him about the very origin stop now, because someone's...
Okay, what we're talking about. So you said the very beginning, it was just coffee, espresso. So it really was a coffee shop. Peanut brittle.
Terry's model for it was a place in Florida that was a breakfast place. And wonderful eggs and things. Terry was all about, okay, if you're going to do the bad things, the drinking and the... not bad things. Smoke pot and do toot. You have to eat well. You have to take your vitamins and you have to eat well. So he was interested in that. And so he loved food. I mean, Terry really loved vegetables. He had gone to jail for something. Some kind of drug thing, and he did not turn state's evidence in against the people that he was working with, and so they got good lawyers and got him out. But while he was in, he was on a chain gang in Florida harvesting sugarcane, and he fell in love with the oranges of Florida, the sweet corn of Florida. He just loved it. Jeff Cross came from a construction family. He had some money. Terry had the money from that settlement. So they were doing this thing because Terry loved food, and he was very persuasive with Jeff, who looked to him as a model.
So it opened in September of 79. And when were you married?
We were married in January of 80.
January of 80. And then this first, you said, so then you bought the piano, convinced him to buy the piano.
Yeah.
And the first band was Dave Dreyer and Brian Wilkie. So that would have been in, like, spring or early
in
on?
January.
January?
I mean, we did this pretty fast. We were moving at a great clip.
So he wasn't planning on doing music before that, or he didn't really have plans. It was just opened it up.
No, he wanted to have a coffee shop.
And
he was moving in that direction. And I said, no, we got to put art on the walls and have art shows here, and we'll have music here, and people will hang here and live their lives here, and it will be just a wonderful... It'll be all those things, you know, a child-centered place. And
so why wasn't the Jack Webb band the first band?
Well, it was. I think that it was probably advertising for that that let Dave Dreyer realize that we were in this thing.
Okay. So, it may have been the time, it may have been where he was at, but the story I heard from Terry multiple times was that he remembered, he had the place open, he remembered going to the ground round, seeing the Jack Webb band.
I took him there.
I didn't hear that part of the story. But he said he was there, saw the Jack Webb band, was blown away, remember going up and trying to figure out which one was Jack, and not realizing that it was...
Yeah.
That was Ron and other people in the band, and then the music started after that. So that was the story, the version I heard.
Okay. Well, it's true.
So, okay.
He said to me, you may not like me, but you'll love my dog. He had a wonderful dog. He was living in the basement of Jeff Cross's house, and he had Jason the dog. And I pretty much said, I can't talk and I can't handle my pop, but you got to hear this music. And I don't think at that point Terry had experience with jazz. I mean, that was just not part of his upbringing. Or, you know, he was a jock to his bones, and he loved music. He did. You know, the music of the day. I didn't know anything about. I barely knew who Neil Young was. You know, well, much less Chrissy Hynde and such like.
So you get the piano, Dave and Brian play, Jack Webb band plays. So then what starts to happen? What are some of the benchmarks?
The table is a phenomenon. It was located, you know, a block from the New Music Building, from a couple blocks from Smith Hall, where the Jazzers practiced, right across the street from Cranert. Musicians, the subculture, wants to play. So when we had a good piano, kept it tuned, and I'd also said, here's the thing. I had studied that a healthy art scene takes three parts. Musicians, the artists, audiences, and critics to make it healthy. Critics inspire the artists to do better, the audiences love them, and so on. So another theme from my head, because I had studied a lot about arts and leisure, that was another thing I was interested in, was entry-level venues. So that if somebody wanted to do something, they didn't have to hire a hall. They could just do it. You know, later on that went into the White Street Art Center too, a place where they could perform easily, just set it up. And they had to have the feedback, right? So you have to record it. So I insisted we've got to record this stuff so that they can take it and hear what they play like, right? And then the rest of it just started to happen because it was true. All of those things were true. The musicians wanted to play. It was close and convenient and easy to play.
So what was the other, what other places were doing music at that time? Was Trino's doing music up the block?
Oh, Trino's had always been a jazz hangout thing. But it was quite a noisy thing. Garvey was doing his thing at Trino's.
So was it just the big, I mean, when I came later, it was just the big bands
just
that
the
would
big
play
bands.
Once a week.
Yeah. There was
was
no sense.
The Red Herring doing any music or any jazz at that point?
Not jazz, that I recall. It would do folkish things.
And Zorba's was doing some, but then
Zorba's was just doing Jack Webb band.
Just the Jack Webb
band. I don't know what other jazz groups, if any. Oh, there was a place called Ruby Gulch that was operating for a little while. I don't remember ever going there. It was on Green Street, and it was a young woman who also loved jazz. She was somebody like me, you know, bohemian on the fringe of popular culture, and she had this dream too. It was in the air, like I say, the small places, clubs, and of course New York City, full of them, 52nd Street.
But at the time the table opened, so the table started doing music seven nights a week once the music started, or was that
that gradually happened, you know. No, it wasn't seven nights a week at first. It was on the weekends. And Terry soon figured out, you know, let's cater to the drunk on Thursday people with blues. That kind of, by the time you came, you guys were doing that sort of programming. So the big splash on the weekends, and, you know, Jack, Doc Scott could have his Tuesday nights, and so on.
So the musicians at that point were eager for a place to play.
Yeah.
So it kind of dovetailed. So there weren't, even though there were places that the Ruby Gulch did a lot of out-of-town bands. And that
they
was
did
a
all
earlier.
Out of town, and it wasn't as convenient, and it wasn't as local, and she paid high rent. You see, we didn't. We had low rent, so we could afford
it. And what
that.
Was, so that building that the table was in, mm-hmm. was, there were basically three storefronts.
Mm-hmm.
So when, what else was there at the time?
Horizon Bookstore.
And the middle space was vacant? Or there was something in it?
I think it was vacant.
Because the entire time I was working there from 85 on, that was vacant.
Yeah.
And the table before that, do you know what it was directly before that?
It was a grocery store.
Grocery store. Was it a pizza place at some point?
Oh, it was a pizza place. It was originally a grocery store, and then it was a pizza place and various people. The Dursos owned it, the shoe people.
And what was the, wasn't there a Spud Nuts at some point?
Oh, maybe so, yeah.
I just know people have mentioned these different things, and I just remember what your memory of that space was. But Horizon Books was already there when the table started.
Yeah, I have no memory of it except for the Nature's Table.
So the middle space was vacant. Mm.
And the other thing, you know, the logo that Terry and Jeff had come up with was Eat It Naturally, which I enjoyed in all of its punning. So this, I just knew this is cool.
So let's talk about some of the musicians that played. Let's talk about a little more about 1980. So the ball gets rolling early.
So Bill Westcott was in town. He was a Canadian who played, I don't know, stride rag piano. And he was a slender man with Coke-bottled glasses, red-haired a little bit, kind of odd and bent over. And he would just come in the afternoons and play on the piano. And if Ron was around, you know, he'd bring out the clarinet and the two of them would play. And that was just a total enchanted thing, those sessions that would start in the afternoon and happen. Illinois Summer Youth Music was there, so all of the jazzers had, like Bill Overton and so on, would have gigs in the summer teaching the kids. And the teachers would have ensembles in the evenings when the kids would come. Bill Overton called them junior outness. Bill Overton was around, Bill Westcott, Ron.
We'll talk about Ron Duar and his connection.
Well, Ron, I quite frankly just fell in love with his searing honesty, beauty, musicality. He was so pure, he didn't even leave town. You know, he had a wife who was sick of being as broke as she had to be to live with Ron, and a daughter. He had stayed way too long in town. He wouldn't even teach unless he really liked the student. He was interested in the language of dolphins. He was the one that told me, you know, best thing you can do is a yoga squat. If you just did that every day, you'd be healthy. And he had theories about rhythm, polyrhythms. They were all into African polyrhythms. And they would talk about that. I was completely fascinated. Scott Mordecai. So Ron had his hangers-on. Scott Mordecai and a group of people. And Scott and the trumpet player who I just mentioned.
Art Davis.
They were all into African drumming and taking pilgrimages to African drumming. And I was fascinated about that, and Ron explained it to me, how the polyrhythms had affected jazz always. So later on that would manifest as writing grants for bringing African drummers over. Oh, Oscar Suli was in town. And he was teaching them. And then, who is the other guy? Starts with a W. I wrote a big grant for him and...
plays what?
He was an A-way drummer from... Senior Moment. I'm glad we're doing this interview now while I still have any head space together. Remember later on we brought The Year the Table Closed.
We brought Abu Bakari
Luna and
Gideon
Foley Al-Warrieh. That's where the W was coming in.
So that interest started early on. So that Ron and them were interested, and then Oscar
were,
was
Ron
around.
And Art and Scott and Steve Balderson, they were all interested in that. Deeply and profoundly, and Yeah.
I just remember Ron was had left town by the time I was working there, so he came back to play, but it wasn't a regular thing. But I just remember the reverence that Terry always had when talking about Ron. Like, I could just tell that there was, the music really affected Terry in a deep way. So even though Terry may not have known the music early on.
Oh, he was so affected and responsive to it. There is no doubt about that. And I just want to say, you know, Terry was looking for direction in his life, fresh out of jail, blah, 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 blah. I was full of directions, ideological directions, but I couldn't manifest anything. Terry took the ball and made it into a play. There would have been none of it if Terry hadn't happened. And you see, people are drawn to that. You were drawn to that, and you made things happen. The musicians came because that was the drive of the music, the integrity, the energy, the joy of the music. So that happened.
So Lynn Halliday was around in the early
part? Lynn Halliday caught wind of Ron. And I think he came to town to play with Ron. And Joe Groans, he was a pianist of sorts. He was a English into rhetoric or something at the U of I. And so when Lynn came to town, when Guido came to town, they stayed at Joe's house.
And Guido stayed with John Dahlstedt, JD.
Guido stayed with whoever would have him.
So Guido came the first year as well, pretty much. So this is all 1980s.
Well, Guido came and thought he could just jump into Ron. Ron was the boss. And Guido thought there was no reason why Guido shouldn't be the boss too. And Ron didn't think so. He didn't admire Guido's playing or his assumptions. Now, Ron was, you never walk onto somebody's set. He hates it to this day. I think he stopped playing because people would always come over to his gigs and want to sit in. He hated it. He wanted it to be whatever it was he was interested in it being.
So it's detoured.
Brad Wheeler was there at that time. You know, Stites and
Joel Spencer.
Joan Hickey, Marlene Rosenberg. You know, there was John Campbell was in and out. There was a lot of people who had come out of the U of I. Garvey. Garvey was everything. Garvey was an energy source unto himself. Ron stayed here so long because Garvey had talked to him about timbre. Garvey was a violist, and he knew about sounds. He hated plugged-in guitars and so on. He wanted it all to be rich acoustic instruments. He was all about the blend, the subtleties. He was a moldy fig in that he was interested in the music before bebop. And he influenced DeWar and, you know, Cecil McBee and Cecil Bridgewater and what's his name, the great Neely, Jim Neely. That whole thing had happened in the 60s, right? So we're talking 10 years after that, where the buzz of that time when the Garve Band was sent on a State Department tour. Because why? Because the U.S. was countering the Russian propaganda that we were racists by sending over bands with blacks in them and celebrating artists like Jackson Pollock and jazz that were manifestly free. So this was a counter-ideological propagandistic force to stress the freedom. And, of course, intellectuals all over the world responded to the jazz and this ethic of jazz, you know, which was, if you have to kill yourself by doing drugs to play more creatively, go for it. Burn the candle bright. You know, Charlie Parker and so many guys. And the jazz thing was, I don't know if you read that Pynchon quote that was briefly on my Facebook thing.
Yes.
You know, American blacks were enraged and waiting, and the civil rights thing was brewing in the 50s and the 40s. These cats coming home from World War II, watching it, the lynching that was happening in the 30s and 40s. I mean, this was in the music. this was free blacks just screaming it, you know, it's what it was. So the music had that passion and anger and freedom and damn the fucking torpedoes, you know, I'm not going to wait table, I'm not going to be the house boy, no friggin' way. You think we're stupid? Listen to this, baby. Play this, change this fast. And, of course, classical music had run up against a wall, you know, the out serial music that Schoenberg and those guys were doing had kind of hit a wall. So classical musicians were looking to jazz and blues for gumption, for insight, for inspiration, and the jazzers coming out of blues were looking to classical music for the harmonics. And so the thing was right. I'm talking about the 50s now, in the 60s. So anyway, here's Garvey. He did this thing in this town in the 60s, and then some of these cats were like Ron anyway. He had stayed too long. He should have been New York City by then, but he was Ron. He was not able to do that, not going to do that. Anyway, so in 79, there was this crop of very talented players that came from all over the state of Illinois, you know, and they had this remarkable jazz scene here. It wasn't the kind of scene that Austin, Texas had, you know, North Texas State, or...
That's not Austin.
Wherever that is.
It's in the middle of nowhere.
In the middle of nowhere. Midland,
Denton.
Texas. Denton. Yeah, that had produced Gary Payton and Morgan Powell. That was another people who were quickly on the scene, you know.
Morgan and Ray.
Morgan and Ray.
Sal Martirano.
And Sal Martirano would come and play and do their thing. 1981 was when Ray and Morgan hooked up and started doing the Tone Road Rambler kind of explorations. So
let me detour to the food part. So the music's starting to happen. When does the food start to kick in?
So there was this guy from Peoria, Bloomington. There was a place called Avanti's there that had the gondolette. And this man showed up on the scene wanting... I think he wanted to go into business with Terry and do the gondolette there. And Terry, you know, Terry could be quite generous, but he was also shrewd. He wasn't going to let this guy be a partner. He hired him to do the bread, and the guy did, and then quickly realized that there was not enough money in Nature's Table for both of them, and so he moved on. Terry kept
making the
bread. Ask Terry.
And Jeff Cross was already out of the picture at this
point. Jeff Cross quickly got out when I came in. I was a bit too much for Jeff.
So Jeff was, was he still a partner? Or
no.
He just...
Terry, you'd have to, and you should interview Jeff Cross.
But then it was just you and Terry.
It was just Terry.
Terry. So then this guy comes in to make bread.
Terry started making the bread.
So then Terry took over? Terry was the bread baker then, right after that?
Yeah, I think. He did, and he hired people quickly.
So, was it open for lunch from the beginning, or it was open all the time, even though there was just coffee and...
It was open from 9 in the morning until 1.
Till 1, from the beginning, more or less.
Yeah.
So then, this is 1980 or so, when they start to actually offer more food, bread, and...
I don't know.
Okay.
I think so. I think before he offered sandwiches, but I don't know where he got his bread from.
Okay. But so I'm looking... So when the evolution of what I consider like to be the full menu...
You guys did that.
By the end... No, it's before that.
The cookies were there. I don't know how that happened. I started having babies. You know, Sarity came. We were pregnant with Sarity.
What year was Sarity born?
She was born in February of... 81. So I got pregnant in June of 80 or something, by July. That was the first time we took the Jack Webb Band on the 4th of July float.
Talk about that a little bit.
Well, when I was there before Terry, I was trying to do something, God knows what, with the marching band. And I would follow them around, recording them and marching with them. And I would go to all of the, I was interested in all the manifestations of community life. 4th of July
parade. So this is the U of I marching band.
Yeah, and I lived on Oak Street over there. So I would go up to where they were practicing and I would slip into the assembly hall. And I had fantasies that one day I could choreograph for the baton twirlers and the cheerleaders. I was fascinated by that movement and the music and the sousa. Just, I loved the sounds of horns, basically. So, what was the question? Oh, so...
So there's been a 4th of July parade tradition in Champaign-Urbana for decades.
Right. And you remember WEFT was just starting then. I remember sitting there with my baby daughter in the spring of 81 or summer and listening to WEFT. Of course, WEFT came on the air before they knew they were on the air. And anyway, it was in the zeitgeist that you do the parade, you know. You don't leave it just to the firemen and the Republicans and the Democrats. So I said, let's put them in the parade. And then Terry made it happen. We got the flatbed, we got the tractor, the band was there. I was pregnant with Sarity sitting on it. Chuck Seegerd was handing out his... It was the Reagan era. Could not fucking believe that Ronald Reagan could be elected in this country. Mm-hmm. It was such a shock. You know, we had just gone through... what we thought was the beginning, the sunlit shores of the post-civil rights movement. And then here was Reagan. John Mitchell said in 1968, in 25 years, this country will be so far to the right you won't recognize it. And they started doing the kind of politics as abortion, you know, pro-choice. They started doing this kind of stuff way back then. So it seemed... It was just beginning to dawn. No, it wasn't going to be 4-day work weeks with good pay. There was going to be slave labor 60 hours a week. You know, the world was not going to go the way we thought. It was clear to everybody it should go with no more war. Ever. So there we were. Chuck Seeger was handing out his dollar bills with Reagan on them, and he was marching along in medic scrubs, dancing along, handing out these dollar bills with anti-war slogans on them.
And how was the reception?
Like it would be now. I mean, people loved the band.
Was there a Nature's Table sign or a banner or something?
You know, we might have forgotten that. I
remember Jeff Michael talking about marching with the band, or being part of that. Jeff or Bob Marion, I wonder which one.
Yeah, because there were people sitting in tables as if it was Nature's Table. I was sitting on a table. You know, Terry was driving the tractor. There were people on the float, and the musicians, John Sexton. And.
So who were some of the early workers in both... the bar and the food end when it expanded.
Jenny Cogan, people whose faces I could, and you would know the names, but Jeff wasn't there at first.
I don't think so.
And neither was Bob. I remember Teresa and her tall friend who was in the anti-apartheid stuff. She had a tall...
That would be a little bit later.
It was later.
Jim Joyce?
Jim Joyce, of course. That's right. See, I don't remember. I mean, I'm not calling it forth.
So after Terry was baking the bread, who else started? Who were some of the other chefs that came on? Do you remember?
I would if I saw their faces. I was so, you know, we quickly had a lot of children. I would write the flyers and go around and post things up. I was the flyer girl with strollers and stuff. And the lovely people who worked there, I would see them and I would know them. I remember, and sometimes I get pissed at them. I'd walk in and no one was doing anything. And I said to Jenny, you know, what do you think your job is? And she said, well, maybe, Shelley, we model our way of working with yours, which is you stand around and talk to everybody. There were art books. We kept sketch pads there and markers and things for people to draw. Early on, started doing art shows on the wall.
So how about the...
The food, I don't know. And the cookies, I don't know who started the cookies.
Okay.
Do you?
No. Well, there was the early cookbook.
Well, the cookbook was...
Well, a couple years later.
So all of that food was already in play.
Mm-hmm.
And Robin did so much of that. I mean, you'd ask
and
her...
Robin was there when I started in 85, but that's already...
So she would know who was before her.
Okay.
And Jeff Michael would know. And Jenny would know, Kogan.
So...
Even that asshole Jim Joyce would know. And Jim, if you're listening to this, you know who you are.
So the economics of it. So did it make any money early on?
Well, you know, Terry is squirrely about money. He always was making money from moving some pot around. He would take the cash home with him, and he would lose it every day. It was, God damn it, where's the money? People are robbing me. People are robbing me. No, Terry, they're not robbing you. You'll find it. And he would always find it. And he would do the bookwork, and he would have those notebooks, I think I gave you some, where he would write in the corner.
They're in the archive now.
How much he took in that day. And, of course, we would bleed when the students left. There would be not much money in the summer and not much money in the Christmas break. We started to just close then.
Do you remember when, so early on, was the food or the music bringing in more
money-wise? The food.
The food.
The gondolette paid for things.
And that was the lunchtime business because of the campus proximity.
Right. And then the you know, the big things like the blues and bantukus and stuff, then you make lots of money on booze, on beer.
I mean, by the time I was there, so by 85, 86 or so, lunchtime was definitely the lifeblood.
Yeah.
And what subsidized the whole operation.
Payroll started to get a little bigger, and I have no idea if it was a fair amount that he was paying.
Don't remember.
See, I mean, who knows? We were always hurting. I mean, there was... Kids had free lunch. I got their medical stuff done at the public health thing. We never had... It was never a job that you could rely on. But on the other hand, when we would go off to Florida and camp or something... It seemed to me we spent whatever, you know, Terry was in the mood to spend, and he spent. And I don't know whether that came from...
So early on, Terry's there all the time.
Pretty much.
And then you have Sarity, then Tyson. So when did Terry start spending less time? When did he start having enough people? When did it start having enough energy to move a little bit on its own?
I think when you came.
Okay.
I mean, you were a godsend. But that's why I say that a lot of this is phenomenological. It just happened because we were all desperate for a place to be and live and function meaningfully in that ridiculous time. I mean, this was the recession. Mm-hmm. It was always the recession in our lifetimes.
So let's talk about any musical highlights that you might remember? So maybe out of town bands.
Highlights for me was Bill and Ron and those Sunday afternoons when people were just there hanging out in the evening times. Highlights for me were, you know, Doc Scott and his various incarnations, when people would get excited. Brad Wheeler's gigs, you know, like when guys like Liebman would come. Herb Ellis, that was a nice thing. But then we had the Japanese band, Takio, whatever. They came over, they were playing at Krannert, and they came over afterwards, and we offered them a line of cocaine, and they turned us into the authorities for... We weren't even selling it to them. We were offering it to them. But, you know, musicians are not universally tolerant or interested in...
So what about the... Experiences. It seems to me pretty early on the reputation of the table, musician-wise, was spreading. Because you started to see, Jack McDuff, Groove Holmes, other people.
Well, Jesse brought Jack McDuff.
Jesse did? Jesse Moore?
Yeah. You know, like Russell told us, oh, yeah, this is the only place downstate where a black person could book a gig without a white front person. That's what Russell Cheatham told us. Russell needed a place to play. He came. You know.
But so at that time, the reputation had spread pretty early. Maybe partially because some of the musicians had moved to Chicago.
Yeah, I guess.
Come back.
Of course, yeah.
Because it seemed like people would pass through and would make it.
Look, people would come, they were on a circuit. They were coming to play in Chicago. So what do you do the Thursday night before your weekend gig in Chicago? You could come down and play at this place that you'd heard about. You know, it's a small world.
So from the beginning, so jazz was the start and the heart of it, but there was also, and you mentioned African music. And then there was, you mentioned blues, and then...
I never got into that much, but it was there, yeah.
And then there was folk music, and...
I never got into that. There was that guy, remember that guy, who Ed DeLeo or whatever his name was? And he had his own energy and his own need to play.
But then there was David Porritt, who did the We Say Potatoes.
Oh, David Port. I have a painting of his. Yeah. You know, an Irishman.
Mm-hmm. And a painter. Yeah.
And a painter. I mean, people wanted to do it. It's the entry-level venue. Do it.
So you were doing the schedules, but you were also organizing the art shows.
Yeah.
Correct? So talk a little bit about that.
Same thing. Artists, you need audiences, you need venues, you need critics, you need enthusiasm. It's the responsibility of the venue to do the advertising for you. The responsibility of the artist is to put it up. And then you have, you know, some openings so that people could come and talk, and maybe they sell it. That would be good. Nobody had any money.
I remember Terry would have us prepare for the art openings. We would get loaves of bread. We'd cut them up into small pieces. We'd get a bunch of apples, cut up the apples, because we didn't normally have apples, and brie cheese, which we didn't normally have. So there'd be brie, apples, and bread. And then gallons of white wine, usually, big jugs of it.
Because that was my take on hoity-toity art things. That's what you would do, you know, little canopies and stuff. Mm-hmm. And Terry made it happen.
But there was pretty much art constantly throughout the duration.
It attracts itself. Entry-level art venues and politics. You know, I was so excited when there flyers. You put the flyers on the wall about the anti-chief. You put it was community networking. Get these ideas out. And because people like you needed a place to put your flyers up and maybe sometimes in my fantasies meet and have a conversation with people, mm-hmm. you know, and of course the idea of giving jobs to people who gave a shit about something.
Yeah, there were a bunch of us activists there, as well as musicians, artists, dancers.
Because people who are drawn to the integrity of one voice are usually responsive to the integrity of these other expressions.
I remember in the last couple years, when the anti-chief stuff was happening, Terry had gotten from Charlene Teeter some shirts, and we were selling those shirts as well as Nature's
exactly.
Table shirts. Yeah, I mean, that was a place. I mean, there was a lot of people who would just come to talk and hang out in the after the lunch rush, before the evening time music.
Just to be there, to have like the old idea of a salon. You know, in the salon, some aristocratic lady like Gertrude Stein, funny aristocrat, but mixed metaphors there, but somebody would have open house where artists, poets, intellectuals would come and they would share ideas. So that's an old idea. So this was a salon. I thought of it in a certain sense, egocentrically, as my salon, but I realized that it was a phenomenon of its time. It reflected all of these ideas in play that we were all working on. We were all trying to keep something alive. You know, when they wanted to eminently domain it, and I was going into Weir and those people telling them, you know, you need a bohemian fringe in your sterile campus town. You don't have anything. You have the red herring and you have Nature's Table. That's it.
So let's talk a little bit about the end.
Yeah.
So my memories were one that, I don't know if Terry ever tried to expand into the middle space at all, but I remember the U of I at some point had bought, so Horizon Books owned their space. The U of I owned the middle space, which was vacant at least for the 5 or 6 years that I was there. And then Durso owned, was the absentee landlord who owned the table space, and Terry took care of all the maintenance and everything on it. And we kind of knew that that was in their plan. That's why they kept that middle space. That was their footprint to get it.
Yeah.
So when did the inkling start to come that this was going to end, at least over there?
For a while, a couple of years. We would always talk about ending it, too. We'd be exhausted, and we'd drive around in the car, and we'd say, okay, that's it, we're done. But now here's where the flip side of the drugs come in. You know, if we had been less interested in being high or less debilitated by it, we perhaps could have gotten it together to make some sort of business plan to move somewhere else. You know, the U of I planners used to say, oh, don't worry, we're going to build this enterprise zone between Goodwin and Lincoln. Well, yeah. That never happened.
Well, they did build the space, but it was like 20 years later, 15 years later.
It was 15 years later, and it would have been very expensive. See, the whole thing that made Nature's Table possible was that we didn't have a huge rent nut to crack, so we could play. But no, I was asking the university to give us some other piece of property right in that area, because the ecology of location, location, location near the music school was so important. Give us another place where we can be for 15 years. We'll do this for our lives. We will provide this service. And, you know, a lot of people were talking about, Ray Sasaki talked about, this is a school without walls. You know, Socratic place where people would talk and teach each other, musicians, blah, 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 blah. So there were so many good things about it. And for me, because I believe that I'm excited by the possibility of true anarchy in that people build lives that are value-rich given the opportunity. And that if you're intentional, you can do so much for yourself and everybody else on the planet. So a lot of the things that went into the table were very clear intentions, and Terry understood those intentions and had them himself. As an athlete, he was used to lending his body to the game, to the team, to passing the friggin' ball. He got that too. That was the best, I think of it as the best culmination of the good stuff about sports. It's a collaborative energy endeavor. It's the glory of the athlete. So these were intentions in play. And the money worked because it wasn't expensive. Sorry. wasn't expensive.
So when it finally came down that they expressed their intentions, and they didn't have to eminent domain because Durso was willing to sell, and it was his property, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. But I remember we organized a bit. Terry was hesitant at first, I recall. I remember Scott Peters and I helped form a group called U of I Watch, where we did at least that one forum over at the YMCA. Mm-hmm. Where you were there. Other stuff. And we did get a petition going.
And I took those names to Morton Weir,
who was the chancellor of the U of I at the time. Mm-hmm. And the response you got was basically what?
Thank you, nice lady. I so agree with you. We need everything you say. Good luck.
So they weren't, there was no real?
No real. They sent over their planners that showed us the plan for this enterprise zone that materialized 20 years later. I mean, they were oily. They had no reason to pay attention to us. That was disappointing to me. Here I was putting heart and soul into everything I'd learned at Leisure Studies, and no one of my professors ever came in to take a look at it. Hmm. I thought it was, you know, here I'm doing it, guys. See, this is what you... This is ideas I got from you all. Do you not see how this is functioning? Nope. Occasionally we'd get a student in who wanted to do a study about musicians or something. But so then I thought, oh, there's no real interest because it's outside the journals and the things that they need to make their reputations. So there's no reason for them to be genuinely curious in these phenomena. Jazz or people working or activism. Nobody came to study the anti-chief movement. Nobody came to study the anti-apartheid movement. Where were the fucking students who had this going on in front of them? Where were they studying this?
Well, I remember being, I think that was the first time I started looking at the U of I master plans. I think I'd heard a little bit about it because Strawberry Fields had, they were the first ones to brush up against it. When they built the Beckman Institute.
All right.
And that would have been
early
80s, right? No, late 80s.
When they first moved to Green Street?
Yeah, they moved to Green Street because... so that would have been the late, because the table was happening. I was working there. But Strawberry Fields tried to fight.
Yeah, no, there's no way.
And I remember that was the first time hearing about these U of I master plans. And then when we were looking at it, I remember the point we were raising was... They made these master plans with no concept of what was there. It's just like, our plan is to grow and is to go here and go there. But it didn't matter what was being stepped on in
no.
the process.
No.
And I remember looking into that, and we brought some people to talk about that and talked about the planning issues. What is planning? You know, what are you planning for? What do you plan around? What do you plan with? And most of them didn't care.
No.
And since then, I mean, in the intervening years... I mean, there's just...
They got what they wanted.
...pushing more and more and more. I mean, the development that eventually came on the other side of Cranert there on
It's all
on
highly
Nevada.
Commercial.
Well, there's just these spaces that only chains can go into.
Yeah.
I don't even know how a small business can...
You can't.
...carve
it's
out
too
something
expensive.
in a new building with zero character.
Right.
I mean, all the downtown Champagne spaces are starting to be occupied... But there's, you know, when in old buildings that can be rehabbed to actually
right.
have character. I mean, I'm not saying that the table building had inherently had a bunch of character.
All
but
of those downtown spaces are being taken up by essentially chains. Carlos and his buddies are a chain. I mean, they got, it's like the Republicans. They got in Donald Trump with the seeds they sowed. And the U of I planners have chain stores, apartment complexes designed to attract yuppies from Asia, or, you know, it's they aren't interested in Seoul.
Now, did the Terry near the end, was he interested in moving it? Was there an effort to find a space if the U of I wasn't going to, or was it kind of like
he was, you know, he had four little kids, he had me as a wife who dreamed more than she. Did. He was working 7 days a week there. there was no headspace. And he was smoking a lot of pot and probably drinking a little more than he should, and not smoking a lot of pot. I mean, I think he functioned on the pot.
I just don't remember if there was a lot of... Because I know a couple of us, myself, Danny Deckard, Lisa Kinnar, a little later, Paul Winky, we tried to look at a couple places. Remember, we looked at... But there was, to us, the key to do a Nature's Table 2 would be that it had to be... We'd had to have the same balance.
Right.
Of food, of accessibility to the university, and then of a music space, that they couldn't really exist without it. And everything we started looking at was a little too far. We looked at the Tritos on University, which has now been finally torn down just the other day. It's been a bunch of... It was vacant for forever, but that was kind of too far away at the time. We looked at Bike Works. That didn't work. We spent a lot of energy looking at that.
I remember looking at that, too.
Yeah,
yeah, we did go around looking at places, too.
Because Terry may have actually been kind of partially interested in what we were doing.
No, he was. I remember we would go and look, too.
Okay.
We would drive around looking.
I think we even started getting some blueprints for the Bike Works place, but that fell apart.
Right, I remember that.
I mean, I think we invested too much of our...
Time doing that.
Time. But I don't, you know, but we didn't have any capital, either.
See,
none of us.
So. Terry had that initial capital, he and Jeff, to do the table, and that was gone. We'd spent it.
Yeah. Well, by 91, the world was different, too, than it was in 79.
Yeah.
I mean, so the table basically encapsulated the 80s. It started a little bit before, dribbled a little bit after, but it was in
the Reagan era, yeah.
So, any final thoughts, comments, the legacy of the table?
Oh.
Why we're still talking about Nature's Table in 2016?
Because of all of the way it functioned at that time, and the realness of it, and the love of it. You know, people loved each other. Bob and Jeff and you and Lisa and all the kids, and, you know, Lisa Dixon worked there, you know. Val. We haven't talked about Val. You should interview her.
Sure.
There was just... It's what can happen given the phenomenology of it, you know. You see how hard it is to reconstruct, and when Terry tried to do Sweet Betsy's, it couldn't happen again the same way. I think that was a huge disappointment. I think it... And what he did is he processed that disappointment, compounded it. So, glad we were all part of it. It was cool. And, you know, it's there's a continuation at the Iron Post. Even if its owner is a Carmudge, he's just one of the characters we, you know, love and look at, and Brooke and Holly and... You know, the people now, what that lovely Martin, you know, it bar life is a cool thing. The people who come, we talk to each other, you know, we listen. That's how we maintain our lives. If the Post weren't there, I wouldn't be here. I would have gone. You know, something happens to you, I'd probably leave. You know, I'd rent the house out and say, that's it. When Helgeson succeeds to smoke and drink himself into non-apexy, it'll be a very different situation. But for now, it's lovely and it's continuing. Nothing lasts forever.
I think that's a good note to end on. Thank you.